guess you notice we have a wandering front door. The main problem is don't wander out of the old one. This evening we want to point up a few more or less recent findings which indicate that Western psychology is beginning to move from some of its most cherished footings and is coming rapidly into a kind of partnership with both Eastern and Western mysticism. Perhaps one of the simplest points is a new attitude arising concerning the problem of pressure and the effect of pressure in producing psychotic tensions and trauma. Actually, a complex or any negative psychological fixation is not of any particular importance in itself unless in some way it receives nutrition. Like everything else in the world, a fixation must feed. It must be nourished. It must be sustained in some way. And the individual who is developing a pressureful interior life is likely to begin by trying to break up fixations or attitudes which seem to be causing him trouble. It might be likened roughly to a situation of a skillful prize fighter and his advantage over an unskilled opponent. The chances are the opponent will not last long. He won't have a chance. But if you take this skilled prize fighter, lock him away somewhere and give him no food for 30 days, a much less skillful man could defeat him, simply because his energy is reduced. His strength is partly, at least, destroyed. In time, it could be completely destroyed. He must therefore be fed. And nearly every problem that we nurse and nurture depends upon its nutrition for its authority as a problem. Remove the nutrition, the problem becomes less and less real. So instead of attacking all of the various mental attitudes separately and attempting with rather obvious Western violence to uproot them, there probably are simpler ways of overcoming most of the abnormalities that we suffer from mentally and emotionally. One of these ways is simply to remove the source of energy by means of which the problem is maintained. Now, the source of energy in the average individual is also the same energy by which, through unreasonable action, he contributes to the problem. Problems arise from the misuse of energy. Situations become more difficult to the degree that we continue to devote to them unwisely energy which might have more constructive and proper channels of expression. The individual, for example, who has a quick temper or a bad disposition temperamentally, his temperamental disposition could not exist without energy. It takes a great deal of energy to have a good temper fit. It takes considerable energy to have a good crying spell. It takes quite a bit of energy to hate somebody. It takes energy to criticize people. It takes energy to be sorry for ourselves. It takes energy to reject life. It takes energy to break patterns. And it also takes energy to create patterns. Thus, nearly everything that comes out of our complex characteristics, everything is what it is because of the energy that we bestow upon it. If, therefore, we are confronted with a situation that is not what we want it to be. One of the simplest and most direct ways of annihilating that situation is to starve it out. So simply turn from it the kind of energy by which it can survive. To reduce the available energy to support a psychosis is difficult for the reason that the person is not always able either to control himself or to know what particular type of control is most indicated in his case. Yet again, the problem remains comparatively true as we see around it in life. The dandelion and the palm tree grow out of the same earth. They derive energy according to their natures. Paracelsus pointed this out long ago. Therefore, complexes of many kinds and temperaments of many levels derive their individual expressions from common life supply. The life supply, totally turned away from the individual, terminates his existence utterly. And as he goes into this state of non-objective existence, his problems, as far as his personality concerned, disappear, at least in their relationship to other people's. But energy is our answer. And energy is something that the average person does not adequately control. He wastes it. We waste it every day. He dissipates it. He builds tensions within it, which finally cause it to break through because he has obstructed normal patterns of life. And though he may not realize it, in most cases his energies are greater than his abilities to use them. And this becomes a very important issue. When we say abilities, I mean manifested, immediately available abilities. Certainly energy could be used to create greater abilities in the individual, but he is not always inclined to use energy in this way. Actually, most persons are restless. They are frustrated in some way, simply because their natural energy expressions do not have adequate outlets. Now, energy flowing desperately outward will do the same thing as a flooded stream. It will break through dams. It will destroy good land. It will break through dikes and embankments and flood important communal areas. Energy out of control floods the mental and emotional life, resulting in excesses of numerous kinds, which arise always from lack of control. So in the Eastern and the mystical way of thinking, there's an important clue to control a directed behavior, and this is energy sublimation. The supply of energy not called upon falsely. Energy is a kind of reservoir. We do not control it. It is available in nature. But as the waters of a reservoir are piped with numerous faucets and outlets into millions of homes, so universal energy is tubed or piped or channeled into the lives of living things. Here, various faucets regulate its release into usage. These faucets can be controlled, at least in part, by the person. And thus he can determine the amount of energy that he uses. But this does not mean that he exhausts any potential cause of energy. The release of energy through his own nature has certain requirements, certain normal purposes. If these purposes are variously blocked, it is as we would find in a home where a difficulty arises in the plumbing and the basement is flooded, or something of that nature. It is observable in psychological problems that the control of the amount of energy can have a very important bearing upon the problem itself. Now, one thing, of course, that we always have to bear in mind is that if we turn off a house meter, we turn off all of the available outlets. If we throw a switch or blow a main fuse in an electric circuit, then all the lights on that circuit are killed. And our thinking in energy has been that the individual who begins to control his energy begins to reveal lack of energization in all of his activities. In other words, he becomes lackadaisical. He loses ambition. He becomes too sedentary in his ways, too phlegmatic, and is left behind in this great race of life. One of these days we may be learn that the fellow that is left behind is the one who first enjoys a little peace and quiet, but we are not quite to that way of thinking as yet. But the accusation that is most often turned against mysticism is that it leads to a life of non-action. It causes the person to cease to be a valiant champion of some cause or other, real or imaginary, with which most persons keep their lives occupied. This is where the control, however, is without direction. If you want to turn off a faucet in the kitchen, you do not need to turn off the water at the curb or ask to have the city turn it off at the dam. It is perfectly possible for the individual to direct or control specialized uses of energy as these usages arise within his own understanding and need. Zen, coming into the life of Western man, and it is moving rapidly in the life of Western man today, is simply an Oriental adaptation of the thought or the basic theme that what we think is important is only important because we think it is important. Therefore, more or less empirically, the amount of energy used by us in any particular undertaking is determined by our own attitude as to the relative importance of that undertaking. Two individuals both suffer a grievance, or perhaps have mutually antagonized each other. To one of these persons, this antagonism becomes the basis of an enduring disregard. Hatred sets in. The most violent, negative, critical, condemnatory emotions are given expression. The other person, who is a party to the same grievance and perhaps has contributed to it or suffers from it, simply does not have this attitude. To him, a person taking a small matter so seriously is humorous rather than desperate. So he simply laughs off a situation that is going to cause another human being years of misery. The difference is the amount of libido that these two persons are willing to expend on something. Now, we cannot deny the fact that persons are born with two essentially diverse dispositions. One individual finds it completely simple to remain detached from the primary pressures of life. The other individual finds it almost impossible to extricate himself. His every instinct is so intense and so extremely personal that he cannot resist any challenge which can possibly stir him up and cause him to become involved in the situation. Where the sense of humor is deficient, this difficulty intensifies. But if you look around you, you will find individuals of comparatively equal intelligence, of approximately similar inherent talents and capacities, who react entirely differently to approximately the same stimuli. To one individual, the instinct is to fight back. To the other individual, the instinct is not to fight back. Now we look at the individual who does not fight back and we say, is he a coward? Is he afraid to fight back? Or we say, is he so stupid that he doesn't know he's been insulted? That's quite possible. And we begin to analyze his potential deficiencies. Because we assume that if he was a nice, normal, happy person, he would get mad. If he does not follow this expectancy, we consider the serious possibilities that there's something wrong with him. On the opposite side of the picture, the individual who fights back, why does he fight back? He fights back perhaps because he has been insulted. And a person insulted, as one of the old Greek philosophers explains, is in a very precarious position. It only is an indication that he does not know his own weaknesses. Because the moment a person is wise enough to be insulted, he knows so many of his own shortcomings that no one else's discovery of them would be much of a discovery. A man who is insulted can turn and say, I could tell you many things about me more worthy of insult than the thing you have selected. Well, this would be rather devastating. And would probably ruin the day for some belligerent. I've seen things like this happen. And the belligerent one pauses for a moment and then suddenly stands back and laughs. The pressure is off of the entire situation because the individual has not permitted it to be pressureful. Pressure of this nature is nearly always illusionary. Pressure is pride. Pressure is offended hypersensitivity. Pressure is the determination of arrogance to force a situation, whether it is right or wrong. Pressure in almost every instance arises from the direct abuse of our energy resources. Instead of using our energies to build with, we are using our energies to fight with, to fight against shadows, to create within ourselves patterns of tension which continuously energized ultimately become so habit-ridden, so completely possessive of us, that we surrender to them utterly and abjectly. Mysticism has always been a quiet way. It has always been the way of non-violence. Yet mysticism, in its great exponents, has never been weak. This idea that mysticism must be weak and negative simply arises in a civilization that is determined to justify its own lack of self-control. The mysticism of Jesus was not weak. Jesus recommended strongly that if a man is struck upon one cheek, he turn the other also. If the average person of today performed such an action, he would be called a coward. Yet it is often a greater test of interior integration to remain poised and calm than it is to express violent displeasure by means of which other people think you are defending yourself. Now we have this situation also to bear in mind. We certainly desire, wherever possible, to keep the good esteem of other people. We do not wish to be regarded as eccentric. We do not wish to be labeled as weaklings. We do not wish to lose a certain propriety of status. On the other hand, is it necessary for us, in order to maintain our social position, to commit actions that endanger our health and security and perhaps even our lives. It's like the problem of the genial host. Years ago, New York, in the days of the open saloons as they used to be when they were really great social centers and you had 5 cents worth of drink and $4 worth of free lunch, that type of situation once actually went verily on its way. And I have definitely seen fine top sirloin steaks go for free along with a 5 cent stein of beer. Well, those days are gone, but the problem we're in is the bartender. Now, the bartender certainly does not wish to make a bad impression. At the same time, every one of his customers wants him to drink with them. If he succeeds in doing this, he will not be a bartender very long. So the bartender, notoriously, is a man who does not drink. He seldom, if ever, drinks with anyone. And that is a known fact. No one asks him. Now, when this arises in the problem of living, we can say that the person who is continuously trying to please those around him by reacting as they expect him to react has only two choices. Either to be the bartender who drinks when everyone wants him to and very shortly develops ulcers, or to make some kind of a clear statement of his own values in this matter, either by revealing it or by affirming it. To the degree that he will not be expected to make himself sick in order to make himself companionable. So in mysticism, this situation of the person being different, which does irritate, aggravate, and horrify certain individuals, the process of being different in order to be healthy is a decision that thoughtful persons have to make. Mystics in general have been different without being obnoxious. And that is where the line of social proprieties come in. But in life, we must either settle down to being like others, and with doing this, take on all of the karmic consequences of the way they act, or we must be like our own principles recommend that we should be, and have strength enough of character to stand up under a certain amount of misunderstanding and even abuse if the occasion arises. For in the universe in which we live, it is much better for us to be abused 100 times than for us to abuse someone else once. Mysticism, by reducing the intensities with which we react to situations, begins to smooth out living. It smooths out living by not permitting everything that arises to become highly personalized. It withdraws energy from areas in which that energy is not important and is non-productive, and applies this energy to other areas which are important and are productive. This brings, of course, a fine point of difference. The individual who, generally speaking, is heavily loaded with psychic pressures generally does not have any area to which he can transfer his energy. He is sick, he is in trouble, he is in the spot he's in because his energy has only a circle of negative outlets, and that these outlets are continually punishing him. To tell this person that he should direct his energy into other outlets might present a problem. He has no other. I know a person who had a bad neurotic situation for many years. They were not very healthy physically, had to live a rather sedentary life. I tried for months to try to get this individual to take a little interest in reading. Here he was a worrier, he was miserable, critical, thinking of himself all the time, loaded with hypochondria, and he finally admitted to me that never in his lifetime had he read a book, and never in his lifetime did he intend to. He didn't enjoy reading books. I asked him why, and the man was absolutely honest. He said, they take my mind off my misery, and I want to be miserable. Well, at least he was franker about it than most. He enjoyed misery more than he enjoyed getting over it. Because he liked to be sorry for himself. This sounds ridiculous. But without the verbal statement of it, it is present in millions of human lives. Innumerable persons, given the opportunity to quietly and symbolically choose between a good constructive interest and self-pity, will cling to self-pity with everything they've got. Because it is such a warming feeling, it makes a certain sense of psychic importance, is a distinction in being the most miserable person on earth, or even in the neighborhood. These things cause the person to feel individuality. Actually, there are many better and more important ways of being an individual, and these should also be carefully considered. Zen coming in with other Eastern philosophies and a certain amount of Buddhism and the general trend of the day toward a somewhat more contemplative reaction to the intense pressures of modern life has given us what is now being developed under the term psychology of values. And psychology of value is a very interesting field that shows that we can't help growing in spite of ourselves sometimes. This begins to analyze normalcy in the term of the individual's ability to recognize value. That it's no longer a case of him finding out what is wrong with him. This has been one of the big problems in psychology. The average analytical procedure causes the individual to become hyper-aware of himself. The theory, of course, is that if he gets aware of himself long enough and intensely enough and consistently enough, he will in the end get very tired of himself and in that way break away from some of his troubles. But the psychology of value says that it is more important for the person to begin the contemplation of what he should be than the consideration continuously of what he should not be. That the experience of a positive state is highly desirable. The person who is miserable is to a certain degree a person who has never enjoyed being comfortable. If he really had ever enjoyed being happy and had a clear psychic archetypal image of integration, he would find misery an unhappy contrast. But during his entire period of life, he has never sensed by experience a truly positive situation. He was a little miserable as a child. He went through children's ailments and problems. A little more miserable as he got a bit older. His family may have broken up, left him falling around among relatives. Got into school, wasn't well adjusted, a little more miserable. Came out of school, took a job which he didn't like very well, didn't get along with the people around him. Married, made a comparatively inadequate marriage. Maybe not bad enough to be divorced, not good enough to be worth anything. Gradually developed two or three children that became a cause of nervous tension. Against these things, no resources within himself, went to church occasionally, thought the minister was an awfully smart man, especially when he talked on current subjects, and just drifted. A little more problem, a little more tension crept in. Very soon, neurotic situation. The individual gradually sinking further and further into a series of negative experiences. Against these negative experiences, by way of interior contrast, there was no positive experience. the individual knew how it felt to be uncomfortable. He did not really know how it could feel to be comfortable. He heard people tell about it. He heard people say that they were blissfully happy. Didn't mean very much, perhaps a little twinge of envy that somebody else was so much more content than he was. But when a person said they were happy, the only way this half integrated and half demoralized person could react was by his own definition. And instead of recognizing the other person to be happy, he could only say that the other person was not unhappy. In other words, he could create a contrast only to himself and to his own experience. He could only decide that this other person was different, and that certain secret longings or subjective desires that he had intellectualized and emotionally thirsted after did exist. Someone else had them. But he could not even tell what they were, actually. It is very much as though each of us tried to plumb the depths of our closest friend or relative's psychic nature. We might have certain intellectual concept of it, but we could not know what it is. Western man, as we know him today, therefore, theoretically, has never experienced normalcy. He has never experienced any normalcy other than that of the traditional degree of unrest peculiar to the time in which he lived. His idea of normalcy is simply an interlude between wars and depressions, socially speaking. His idea of happiness is the day in which things did not go as badly as they usually do. His idea of supreme joy was to be able to get out of a responsibility. He had no real concept of happiness or integration or purpose that was meaningful. Like the two Irishmen working down in the sewer. And one of them looking over the edge of the sewer saw a valuable, expensive automobile go by, evidently carrying some well-financed citizen. So he turned to his friend, he said, "If you had money as much as that, Pat, what would you do?" Pat said, "I'd buy a new pick handle." And that is exactly the problem we're up against. The individual feels that money would help him not to do the things that he does not want to do. But the positive expression of doing something creative, something valuable, something essentially right in itself, the average person in the West has no experience of it. He does not know what it means. He does not know what it means to be quiet in himself. He does not know what it means to be truly at peace with life. There are exceptions, of course, but the majority of human beings functioning from a continuous existence of tension are able to measure only tension and the diminution of tension. Tension becomes a normal condition. And if the tension begins to let go, the individual senses relaxation setting in upon himself. He thinks of it as sickness or exhaustion. He simply does not have any way to visualize or to release within himself the archetype of essential normalcy. Only we can intellectualize this and say, well, what is normal? In a time when the whole world is confused, what is to be regarded as normalcy? A very simple answer is given to us by nature in this. For man, normalcy is a way of life that produces health. Normalcy is a way of life that makes men well or keeps men well. The way of life in which the person is not afflicted by the negative consequences of his own action. the only way that the Western man can think of that is, well, perhaps if he stays asleep all the time and does nothing, he will thereby not cause himself any trouble. To stop doing everything because anything we do is wrong is very much like the pouting child. But again, that might be the individual's attempt. He might say the only way is to run away from the world, to enter into a cloister or live a monastic life and escape from all of it. The true answer, the answer of a positive adjustment with life and energy, is just so strange to Western man that he has never hardly investigated it. And this is true of psychology. Psychology is trying to put man back again into health by the same brute force and awkwardness that made the man sick in the first place. It is simply a power drive with one policy driving for dominion over another. The physician pushing in one direction and the patient pushing in the opposite direction. But the physician having certain particular instruments of persuasion that are perhaps stronger or more psychologically impressive has a certain degree of success. He can influence the other person against that person's native instincts, to a degree at least. Now, why does mysticism play an important part in this? It is because through a consciousness, through the interior consciousness within ourselves, man is capable of a larger area of experience than his immediate intellection might cause him to believe he possesses. Imagination, the more subtle aspects of human energy directive, causes it to be possible for a person to experience certain states by the natural, positive determination to do so. It is therefore conceivable to the mystic that a state of peace can be experienced by the individual as a direct state within his own nature. And that it is only through mysticism and mysticism alone that a positive state of what might be called a possible good can be directly experienced by the individual. It is by mysticism that he becomes aware of levels of value in himself which become compensatory to the levels of non-value which afflict him on the outside. If this be true, then psychotherapy has to include a certain going inward into the individual's own consciousness by the individual himself, searching in himself for positive roots of expression and usage. He has to search for the missing values and experience them first within himself, and by so experiencing them, gain a means of positive action. If we take the case of Plotinus, the Neoplatonist, we are told that according to his own record, on only a few occasions, two or three occasions during his lifetime, was he accorded the blessed privilege of a mystical experience. In those brief moments, however, Plotinus, being peculiarly blessed among men, actually experienced the state of human integration. He experienced man as himself, fulfilling the human purpose. He became aware of his positive ability to tune into a dynamic reality, to become part of and aware of a dynamic good, whereas it had always previously been that he lived in a dynamic evil and a static good. Evil had a power over him. Good did not. Because evil was active in his nature and in his environment. But good was merely a word, a dim fantasy of value, something that had never been truly vitalized. But through the mystical experience, this vitalization took place. And Plotinus experienced the absolute victory of good over the shadow or absence of itself. He became, in those instants, dynamically good. And by that means, dynamically happy. Dynamically in a state of fulfillment. Dynamically adjusted. And in complete possession of those ordinal virtues with which man's traditional moral life is said to be associated. Such an experience lasted 5 seconds, perhaps less. But it was an experience, not an indoctrination. Plotinus could never have been vitalized had someone explained this to him for 50 years. But because it happened to him, because it occurred within his own life, it became an absolute authority in his life. And he told his disciples that all through the years in which no such privileges were again granted to him, he still lived in the serene, living recollection of that which had occurred. The door did not open again for many, many years. But he knew what was on the other side of the door. He had been through the door. Nothing, no one, could alter this conviction, which he could also re-stimulate in memory, in conscious understanding, in recollection. He could relive it a million times because it had happened to him. Mysticism, then, has this peculiar and wonderful authority of an experience that happens to us and becomes the first important experience against the mediocre. Psychology, realizing the possibility of such a thought, begins to analyze how the mystical experience can be engendered, how it can be conjured out of this mysterious complex of living. There's no use writing it as a prescription because no one can fill it. Yet it is the only remedy, the sovereign remedy, for the innumerable psychological ills of the individual. Actually, of course, the psychotic, the pressure-laden person, is in a very poor situation to have such an experience. Yet this is not totally the fact of the matter. It seems to be. Rationally and even morally, we would assume that the person who is most dynamically wrong is the furthest from the state of being right. The story of mysticism, however, does not sustain that. As we realize from the theophany of Paul on the road to Damascus, here the mystical experience is given to the apostle at the very time he is on the way to persecute the Christians. He has already stoned them. He already struck and seriously injured James the disciple. He had no interest and no faith, whatever. Yet to him was given this experience. This seems to point out that the mystical experience is no respecter of the ordinary conventions of life. It originates in something else. Now, several answers have been given to the Pauline illumination. the distances of time and the inadequacies of records make it very difficult to answer this. Some say that Paul at this time was afflicted with stroke, that something definitely happened in his health which reduced him, which broke him interiorly. Another occasion, another group say that he was stricken with blindness. Some say that he was blinded by the vision. Others affirm that this was not the occasion of the blindness, but was associated with it. If Paul had passed through some immediately preceding disaster, this might very easily explain the matter as a break in the armament of his negative aggressiveness. Other mystics, however, are evidence and clear proof that the mystical experience is not necessarily simply the result of the perfection of the disposition. What it appears to arise from is the reduction of the energy in the negative pattern of the personality. As we suggested at the very beginning of the talk, instead of exhausting the complex, there are ways and circumstances by which it is devitalized, in which the energy being withdrawn from it reduces its activity. It remains what it has always been, merely a small weed in the garden. If we take energy away from it, it will not grow. If it has already grown and we take energy away from it, it will die. We have spent all our time fighting with the weed. We have never realized that it lived by an energy which we can turn on and off, and that it is the turning off of the energy and not the fighting with the result of the energy that gives us our easiest and most lasting victory. Mysticism cultivates within the person who believes it certain religious virtues. Mysticism is founded in the simple doctrines of both Eastern and Western saints, whose lives have been very largely dedicated to a quiet, patient, reflective acceptance of the challenge of living and the continuous and unceasing refusal to become violently involved in problems which are of themselves of no importance, of no meaning, of no essential value, and which rise only to satisfy pride or egotism or a moment's emotional instability. So that your mystic actually is a person who gradually takes the energy away from the whole complex of his own psychic personality. He withdraws his support, mental and emotional and vital, from negative patterns. And these patterns, without his support, without his willful direction, without his bestowing upon them the power of the will, willing them into activity and sustaining them by will energy, if he does not do this, these patterns cease or die back again to such controllable dimensions that they are no longer serious problems in life. The mystic, by his retirement from confusion, by his relaxation away from tension, thereby acquires two situations that are helpful. First, his natural reduction of intensities automatically helps to clarify the psychic field. And the same reduction in tension helps to clarify his relationship with his own basic consciousness. By moderation in his conduct, he thereby reduces any abnormal psychic situation that exists, and at the same time makes available to him and to himself his interior hyper-psychic resources that go beyond even his mental, emotional, or psychic propensities. His end always is the same, namely that he shall experience that which is right, and from this gain the absolute criterion of what he should and must be. Because until he experiences the substance of good within himself, he does not know how he can be good. The question always arises, what must a man do in order to be saved? And until man experiences this as solution in his own consciousness, he can only listen to the advice of others. And this listening to advice is not the same thing. We can listen to advice forever and reject it all. But once we have known something, we have a new level of value, a new standard upon which to erect our own structure of life. Zen and other Eastern systems, therefore, boldly advance what almost might be regarded as a sharp knife, a powerful and directive influence. Instead of wandering around in this misery world of continuous compromises, Zen takes the attitude that this is so, this is not so. The decision is simple. The need for this decision is obvious. The excuses against the decision are numerous, and none of them is valid. The person's own predicament is such that the need for solution is desperately indicated. Therefore, instead of locking ourselves in a vast, involved dispute about this matter, let us visualize the situation as the deathbed scene in which the doctors are arguing as to the medication, and during the argument the patient dies. And that is more or less the situation. While we are making these tremendous philosophical arguments about this and that, our own situation grows steadily worse. And in the midst of all of the defenses that we intellectually conjure to our support, the individual is the living picture of the fact that his position cannot be defended. He proves by his own existence that he is wrong, and then claims by his intellection that he is right. If he continues to do this, of course, he will continue in the difficulties with which he has been plagued from the beginning. Now, in the West, which is not a contemplative world, the search for a Western mysticism, a mysticism not different substantially, for there can be really no East or West in truth, but Western in the sense of being presented in a manner as compatible to our experience as possible, and at the same time not to compromise its basic integrity. This idea of a Western mysticism is growing in importance to Western man today. He cannot be actually the kind of person that he reads about in the stories of ancient Eastern saints and things of that nature. He just isn't that person. But he has the same need as that person. He has a certain basic respect and veneration for the thing that he does need. But he has to find some way of acquiring what he needs, of making it available to him as a personal experience. So psychotherapy approaches this situation. What can we do other than what we are doing in order to help to cleanse this stable of the human psyche and act in the true part of our own Hercules? Obviously, for Western man, this must be brought under some kind of control mechanism. And in that, it's not so different from Eastern man. Certainly, the processes of Eastern meditation are no less scientific than the processes of Western psychoanalysis. Nor are their theories, in either case, superficial. And in both instances, there is a thoroughly integrated formula. It is being done in an almost completely scientific way, although it transcends science as we are likely to think of the term scientific. Meditation is also a person starting from a situation and moving from that situation towards a goal or an end which justifies the consecration of life to that end. In some Eastern nations where meditation has been universally practiced, it is seemingly a thoroughly natural, reasonable, and proper course, and brings no thought of ridicule or criticism in the public mind. In fact, the person may be regarded with a special esteem because he takes such a life. Even as here, he is going to be regarded with the most profound suspicion. Yet the end to be attained is, in both instances, approximately the same. But man, in the West, is thinking of his end in different symbolism. Eastern man thinks of his end, perhaps, as complete emancipation from worldliness. He thinks of the end of his existence is his return to a state of total union with deity. The Eastern mystic has a highly spiritual end which he seeks to attain. To him, this end is the only reason for life, and the existence is a searching for God and good. And the life of godliness and of goodness, these are the proper lives and the important lives, and other lives are comparatively unimportant. In the West, the goal of man is not good in the sense of God, but good in the sense of adjustment with a situation in which he exists. Western man is not seeking to go to a heavenly place. What he probably is trying to do, if he ever was able to define it clearly, is to bring that heaven here. He wishes to bring heaven here. He wishes to perfect the world he is in. Whereas certain mystics have always had the attitude that the sooner out of here, the better. Western man wants to make this world a world of security and peace, and he envisions his daily contribution to the future of his race as a contribution towards some golden age ahead, some utopian world to come, in which all the 5-year plans and the 10-year plans and the longer-range 1,000-year plans and the long-range from the primitive to now 10,000-year plan will sometime result in these plans coming true, and that a generation will come into the world sometime in which there will be no sin and death, and that everything will be as beautiful and wonderful as we might want it to be.